We have a real disconnect at the moment between investor perception of how geopolitical risk registers based on past experience and the present environment where those stabilizers and buffers are less present and less able to fulfill the traditional masking function.
Welcome to another episode of Unearthed, the podcast where we unearth all you need to know about gold and the role it plays in today's societies. My name is John Reed, market strategist at the World Gold Council.
And I'm Joe Cavatoni, co-host, market strategist for the World Gold Council covering the Americas. And today, I think, John, we've got a really exciting show. I think that what we're covering today is a topic that's on everybody's mind, geopolitics.
Yeah, certainly. It's been very much in the headlines in the gold market through the course of November. Our guest today is Tina Fordham, founder of Fordham Global Foresight. Thank you, Tina, for joining us today on this episode. We're really excited to unearth your insights.
Great to be here.
How is the global geopolitical situation at the moment, Tina? Do you think the last few years of tension marks a long-term escalation in geopolitical issues around the world?
Well, thanks, John. I think it's valuable to give a little bit of context. I come to this conversation with 25 years as a geopolitical strategist, about 20 years of those working in financial markets as the chief global political analyst at Citi, first person to hold that kind of role. And prior to that at Eurasia Group, where from 1999, I set up the first financial markets research business on geopolitics on Wall Street and ran a joint venture with another investment bank. And when we first started, in the late 90s, it was all about looking at geopolitical risk in emerging markets as opportunities for developed market investors. Fast forward, and for the first time, we had to think about political risks in developed markets. But prior to the global financial crisis, fiscal cliffs, raising the debt ceiling, the TARP, etc., nobody looked at political risk in developed markets. And so that was the first kind of big evolution, followed by the Eurozone, and then a couple more once-in-a-generation crises, like the pandemic, and then the invasion of Ukraine. So when people talk about sort of recent geopolitical risk, I'm thinking about an evolution over a very long time, during which we have seen both more geopolitical risks, and geopolitics is what states do to project power beyond their borders. So that can include everything from conflict to spying to espionage to tariffs, and what I call vox populi risk. And that's sort of civil unrest, elections that move the needle, etc. So we've seen both of these types of political risk intensify, but they didn't really register much with financial markets. And it's important to ask the question of why that is. The reason is twofold. First of all, central bank liquidity. And on the other hand, and this relates particularly to the Middle East and why we don't see the same kind of transmission mechanism that we have historically in the past, the advent of US energy independence. So liquidity has masked geopolitical risk, but not geopolitical developments, in plenty of wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, Horn of Africa, et cetera. So that most investors would say it's periodic, it's sporadic, or it doesn't have much impact on markets. We've had this succession of once-in-a-generation crises against a backdrop of rising inflation and the interest rate outlook, all converging in the present moment where we are now, where it looks like the US stands a decent chance of avoiding a recession, but we're heading into 2024 with an active conflict in Ukraine, which is systemic, meaning it can trip the wire into the commodities price channel, both food and energy security, and in the Middle East, which, as mentioned, because of the reduced impact of Middle Eastern energy supplies, hasn't really alarmed markets, but could also become systemic if it escalates to include Iran and brings in the US, which has deployed two carriers, I believe, off the coast of Israel in the Med. So we have a real disconnect at the moment between investor perception of how geopolitical risk registers based on past experience and the present environment, where those stabilizers and buffers are less present and less kind of able to fulfill the traditional masking function.
Tina, you've put a lot on the table already. I think what we've actually seen at the World Gold Council, which I think has been a fascinating observation for 14 years, is this ongoing trend of central banks being net buyers, particularly the emerging market central banks. And there's a lot of reasons that you've highlighted: liquidity, safe haven, the ability to secure asset performance that's been motivating the central banks. But I guess from your perspective, does this signal more than just a diversification of their investment portfolios? Does this signal some sort of a shift in the big plates around the dominance of Western markets, the U.S., from that political, that global perspective, or are people reading too much into this?
I think it's important to be very pragmatic at this moment. I think that we've outlined the kind of, used the term shifting tectonic plates. As a political scientist, the term we use is the end of the Pax Americana. So whilst I can't read the mind of central banks, I think it's a very rational response to diversify, because I suspect what they're reacting to is at least some part driven to less faith that the global system and that global risks can be ameliorated. And I think that's a very fair assessment. The United States has been historically, as the late Secretary of State Madeleine Albright called it, the indispensable nation. China had made a big play earlier this year about getting involved in the Middle East as a sort of honest broker earlier on with the Saudi-Iran normalization. But when we had the Hamas attack on Israel, we didn't hear anything much from China. And so the U.S. again pulled back into its historic role in the Middle East, but without as much diplomatic heft, influence outcomes to persuade the Israeli government, apart from perhaps a periodic humanitarian pause, because we're not even talking about a ceasefire. And so linking it back to central bank behavior, there is, I think, some evidence of less feeling of assuredness that conflicts will remain contained. And I think that that's quite reasonable, because the buffers, the diplomacy, the relationships, the moral authority, the muscle that has been present in the past during this period of Pax Americana, the sole superpower moment, has eroded. It hasn't completely disappeared, but I think eroded is a useful term.
Interesting. You know, John, we've done some work on gold's performance and its reaction and its value during these moments of geopolitical events. Maybe you want to comment on that.
It's an interesting dynamic that's playing out at the moment. And I think there's two factors that have been playing a role. One, as Tina has spoken to a degree, is the fact that we have seem to be moving into a period of structural change in terms of geopolitical risk. The behavior of gold during the more acute phases, though, is something I've paid more attention to during my career, sitting on trading desks, you know, trying to work out what's happening in various conflicts and during geopolitical events. In general, my experience is that naturally there is a tendency for gold to get bought when you get a sudden, unexpected pickup in geopolitical tensions, like, for example, the Russian invasion of Ukraine last year, and similarly with the events that are transpiring in Israel and now into Gaza. So gold gets bought. The buyers tend to come from the leverage markets, the faster markets out there. So typically, investors and speculators who are holding short positions on the futures market in the United States, on the COMEX futures market, that seems to provide the first impetus behind the move higher. And depending on positioning at the time, so if the market is net short or there are large gross shorts out there, that can take gold quite quickly higher. It then triggers algorithmic or technically driven buyers, and that can continue for a number of weeks, potentially a couple of months. But barring any further escalation, and we very much saw this after Russia invaded Ukraine, once that short covering algorithmic buying has taken place, and it might last a month or two, then gold tends to drift lower because, after all, the world doesn't end, or at least it hasn't so far. And I think that's what we're seeing as well during the current event that's taking place, first, as I say, in Israel and then into Gaza. So gold has traded higher, but I don't see necessarily the ingredients for it to go on and push higher. And my expectation here is that probably what's taking place, as horrific as it is in the Middle East, is probably pretty much fully in the price at the moment.
I think that that would have been true if it was 2006 and 2007, which was the last time we had a big uptick in geopolitical risk. And again, that's the oil price trigger, which is less of a factor this time around because of U.S. energy independence and everything else. But I think that the risk of this conflict escalating is not priced in. And it is something that I think is going to stay on the watch list heading into 2024, because I believe that Israel is going to press this a lot further than it would have done, again, had there been more influence from the U.S. So I think markets are kind of reverting to an old playbook as we think about the Middle East conflict.
And that's a really interesting insight, Tina, because I'm good at old playbooks because I've been doing this a long time. And I think that what I've described is the traditional market reaction to a sudden upsurge in geopolitical tension. I mean, clearly there are potential for other players to get involved, but I think you're right. I think the market's dismissed that as a real possibility at this stage and is happy to almost like retreat in towards the end of the year and take their eye off the ball here. So it'll be very interesting to see how things play out.
So Tina, on the conflict in the Middle East, is this a function of literally the US and Western markets just continuing to get spread too thin? Too much financial pressure on their ecosystems? How do you kind of assess it? And you're saying it's not necessarily priced in. I tend to agree with you. I think people have kind of just very quickly dismissed it. But let's talk a little more detail around why we think this has the potential to be much more substantial in its impact in 2024.
Sure. Well, part of my kind of methodological approach is to be holistic. And with that in mind, the interlinkages between these various hotspots figures pretty prominently. So I've called my 2024 outlook inflection point. And of course, in mathematics, an inflection point is where the line starts to curve. And is it going to curve sharply, modestly, up or down? That's what is at stake. And if I was being really pessimistic, I would have called it tipping point, by the way. So this is me trying to have a positive outlook, because what I'm trying to suggest is that we can't even really draw a decision tree for the number of actors involved and the stakes that are at play. And when we talk about sort of markets pricing in, not pricing in, part of where I've gone with my approach is toward cognitive behavior theory, in fact. Market participants, just like humans in general, aren't great at preparing for the worst. They tend to engage in normality bias, confirmation bias. And the idea that Iran would attack one of the U.S. vessels seems unthinkable, but it wasn't that long ago that that kind of activity was happening. The difference is that the U.S. would respond militarily more dramatically than it did in the early 2000s, where we had this kind of activity. And you've got a lot of traders in the seat who weren't back at that time. So there is a generational sort of disconnect, Fed put or whatever it might be, that's at work. And when I talk about interlinkages, the outcome for Ukraine is starting to look potentially different the longer that the Middle East conflict goes on. And then the key variable of particularly US elections, but not only, figuring in, because the other aspect of the Middle East conflict that we wouldn't expect markets to price in is the extent to which this war is breaking social media and impacting the global left in ways that could influence election outcomes. So you wouldn't see that in the oil price or the gold price or any of the traditional kind of asset classes that reflect geopolitical risk, but we're already starting to see it in the outlook for voting behavior. Here in the UK, where the Iraq war kind of impact on labor is still felt, plus the left and its sympathy for the Palestinian cause and the impact that could have on the labor turnout, as well as Biden and the coalition on the left. So we really haven't been in this place before. It's not to say I think that there should be a dramatic reaction in any, again, of these traditional indicators, but the ricochet effect and the transmission mechanism is really different than in the past.
You talk about the 2024 election. It's amazing. The behavior patterns that we have in the U.S. in particular around gold buyers is that they jump in when they see the left in the seat of power. They kind of feel good about things when they see the right in power. Can the election in 2024 have such a substantial impact on the geopolitical landscape? How do you see that? When does that start getting priced in?
And this is, I think, the most interesting and complicated juncture, you know, bringing together all of these issues, because you're very right to say it's the populist left that bothers markets, not the populist right. It's spending by the left and not spending by the right. This is very well documented. And with that in mind, I'm concerned that with 2024, and it's US elections are the big inflection point, but we've got 2 billion people going to the polls. It's going to be the biggest year for elections in human history of holding elections.
How many do we have? Is it 40 some odd elections I think you've talked about?
There are dozens, but the big democracies, Mexico, India, Indonesia, you name it, and all still experiencing the pandemic hangover, cost of living, other variables that are broadly going to be unpredictable, but I would say is a shortcut, not great for incumbents, whoever they are, regardless of left or right. I think there'll be a little bit of a mood to punish, but I want to make what I think is a strong point and one that I've thought about quite carefully, because as you know, someone who's originally from the US, but living outside of the country for 25 years, I have seen how polarized the debate has become and how sort of selective nature of thinking about facts and analysis going on. And I also just spent this week in Asia talking to World Gold Council clients, where we had healthy debates about their number one question: what does a Trump 2.0 presidency look like for the world, not for the US taxpayer, for the world? And so if I concentrate my remarks on that alone, let's just go with what Trump has said. Withdraw from international organizations. Stop aid to Ukraine. So international organizations, does that mean NATO? Probably. Stop aid to Ukraine, transactional diplomacy. Which global leaders are excited about that? Mohammed bin Salman, Xi Jinping, Bibi Netanyahu. What does Putin think? Again, we're not mind readers here, but having started my career as a post-Soviet expert, a Russianist, doing field work in that part of the world, I'm very much of the view that an agreement with Ukraine that resulted in the loss of territory would encourage Putin and others to bite off bits of other countries. A military historian I know has remarked that 85% of all global conflicts in history have been wars over territory. And an end to enforcing the post-war international architecture, where we haven't had wars over territory until Ukraine, I think would mean almost open season. So many countries have disputed borders. It's almost hard to think of one that doesn't. So a Trump 2.0 might be great for the US economy. I will leave that to economists to answer, but from the point of view of the international security architecture, I think we'd be looking at another acceleration of challenges to security and borders.
I think you're saying it right. He's tempting this demise of Western dominance in terms of the political and the geopolitical landscape, right? Tempting fate.
So what does it look like on November 5th in the gold market, if I can ask the question, if there's a decisive victory by Donald Trump, which I think is a low probability that anybody gets a decisive victory in these polarized times. But what does that look like, John?
It's a tricky one. I mean, a lot will depend upon what is priced in as you run up to the election. We saw a big reaction after the first Trump victory, perhaps because it was a bit unexpected. It certainly was not, I think, everyone's default expected result. So we saw gold initially trade a lot higher on the expectation that we would be living in more interesting times. But then gold came straight back down again because the bond market moved, thinking about the domestic economic implication from Trump's economic policy. I haven't checked, but I would imagine that there is a lot of volatility buying going on for early and mid November in the gold market, and probably in lots of other markets as well, because I think there will be the expectation of shocks, both in the results, but also in the statements and the first intentions from the new president. It's certainly looming large, I think, in all of our calendars for next year. And whilst there are 2 billion people that are voting, I know which 330 or 340 million that I'll be paying the most attention to.
So the two things that I'll add to that, Tina, will be, I think, a Trump win will actually bode well for two of the biggest factors that we've had supporting the gold price over the last 3 years, which have been questions and preparation for increased concerns around portfolios by the central banking community and a strong retail buying community in bars and coins onshore here in the US. So I think that there tends to be this flock to safe haven by the right and also by retail in the US. So I think a Republican outcome, or for that matter, a Trump win, will probably bode well again for retail demand in the US market.
And a Trump win would probably bring a strong performance for Republicans in Congress as well. It has the potential to be extremely interesting, but I want to address your timing point because I think it's really worth emphasizing here, especially for a global audience, that polls at this stage of the game, a year out, have zero predictive value. I mean, they really are never, ever right. So if you like the parlor game, you know, go for it. But unfortunately, just like in other countries, Americans don't really start taking this seriously until much closer to the time. And that means, unfortunately, September of next year.
That's really interesting. So maybe I can forget about this then for another 9 or 10 months before we start paying attention after the summer. One thing we haven't really discussed, although you certainly made reference to it at the margin, is China. We've seen a tremendous growth in the economic strength and the geopolitical influence of China over the last couple of days. And yet there's been a deterioration, I think, in the relationships between the West and China, particularly, I guess, over the last, I don't know, you tell me, 5 years or so. What do you think that means for the world? It sounds as if it's an integral part of the erosion of Pax Americana, as you spoke about earlier. But is there something specific we should be watching in China and paying attention to, would you say?
Well, thinking about how leaders behave, when there are difficulties at home, their attention is always drawn to the domestic agenda. I mean, I like to say, as uncharitable as it sounds, most leaders can only deal with one big problem at a time. And with that in mind, I wasn't surprised that President Xi toned down the wolf warrior rhetoric at the APEC summit. I feel like investors are ready to declare an outbreak of peace when I think it's a little bit premature. We could call it a geopolitical risk pause in rhetoric, but remember there was an effort earlier this year to kind of make nice between the US and China. And then we had the hot air balloon shenanigans, which resulted in canceled meetings again. So it's pretty fragile. But the thing to watch for, John, is does China change its objectives, which is to remake the international order? China wants to change institutions or create new parallel institutions to challenge US hegemony. China and Russia have one big thing in common, which I feel is forgotten, and that is they want to each act as the regional hegemon in their part of the world. Now, their neighbors aren't that keen on that. And I think investors forget that too. There's an oddly totalitarian instinct amongst market participants that seems quite happy to carve up the world into spheres of influence, except that's no guarantor of peace either. And, you know, again, with reference to the Asia trip, you can look at plenty of opinion data that shows that the countries of Asia are about equally concerned about Chinese dominance as Japanese dominance based on World War II memories. And so that's where this outcome of US elections matters a great deal to American security treaty allies like Korea, Japan, Australia, etc. because, again, this redrawing of borders, talk to India, how it feels about its disputes with China and Pakistan. You know, this is the complexity there. So a improved rhetoric between Washington and Beijing, wonderful. We've got enough to worry about. But until I see a new sort of security paradigm from Beijing, I'm going to assume that it suits Xi Jinping to be more friendly, panda diplomacy or whatever we want to call it. And there's no change in China's objectives to challenge US dominance.
So that's really interesting. Don't get carried away by the apparent thawing in relationships at the moment. They may just be a reflection of some weakness in the Chinese domestic economy. The underlying ambition of Xi probably hasn't changed.
When we think about all the good we're seeing in the media today with the Biden administration, Biden and Xi, you know, shaking hands, it looks great. Is that policy position that the Biden administration may even get to in the early part of the year going to stick come the election year? How does it look? I mean, is that even the right way to think about it? Like, we don't have a lot of clarity around how the government wants to deal with China, how the government needs to deal with China. You know, when you're thinking about sanctions and things that are happening, you know, there's a big gap around China. Can the administration today get something in place in terms of a policy? And if they do, does it just get scrapped if the administration changes, if we get a Republican win? I mean, are we just putting too much, or am I just putting too much credence on like a good outcome between Biden and Xi in the next 6 months?
Well, I think it suits them both to have this improvement in what diplomats call the mood music. Biden has elections to worry about, and Xi has got his internal domestic economy that everybody understands all too well. So they would both like to be concentrating on other issues. The issue of continuity in US policy toward China is an important one, because I think sometimes that people forget that Biden has carried on all of Trump's policies on China anyway, with tariffs and everything else. Plus, he's added a new dose of kind of industrial policy. So the Made in America or America First is something that Biden and Trump have in common. In fact, if we go even further back in US policy toward China, to George W. Bush, et cetera, both sides really value maintaining a certain diplomatic choreography with periodic upticks in tensions, or, you know, ratcheting up the tensions around tariffs and that sort of thing. The question of whether all bets are off under a return to China is an interesting one. The speculation that I've seen amongst kind of Republican policy types anyway is that, given Trump's public remarks about what he plans to do in terms of retribution toward previous adversaries, hollowing out the civil service, et cetera, the expectation is that he might subcontract China policy to China hawks. And one thing that I think most people know by now is that it is a bipartisan position in America, one of the few that exist, to be tough on China. And so I wouldn't expect an improvement in relations so much as perhaps more transactional diplomacy, which is tough for markets too, don't forget, because it seems to come from out of nowhere, as opposed to these carefully signaled statements that are hatched at international gatherings timed when we expect them.
So we've spoken about a lot already on this podcast, and as we come to an end now, what else have we not spoken about that's on your radar?
Well, I get this question a lot. What are the black swans? What are the things that we're not thinking about? And I have a little joke, which is the black swans, the gray rhinos, the fantastic beasts of risk that books have been written about. But if you do the boring work of reviewing catalysts, because that's what these things really are, they're not the structural risks, they're the catalysts, they tend to be stuff that were on all of our lists, but for some reason didn't capture our attention. And I would give the pandemic as an example. I was at Davos every year. The epidemiologists would patiently talk about pandemics and everyone would ignore them. You know, much more interested in more exotic risks. I used to be part of these modeling exercises with the World Economic Forum and others. So the risks in plain sight are the ones that we should look at. And it's actually relapse risk that tends to be the most common. So where's the next conflict going to break out? It's going to be somewhere where we had a conflict recently. And we can see this in Kosovo, between Armenia and Azerbaijan, as well, of course, as in Gaza and Ukraine. These are all historic sites of conflict. So we don't need to reach too far into our imaginations. We need to stress test our portfolios for the kinds of events that are known knowns and do a better job of looking at how the context may have changed.
That's our show for today. Thank you, Tina, very much for joining us and sharing your insights on geopolitics and the gold market. You can find more from Tina at her site, The Navigator, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. We look forward to engaging you on our next episode, where we will be unearthing more insights for you.